I next met with Dr. Terry King from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and she began by presenting a patient from her practice.
So I recently saw a 42-year-old who was diagnosed with the right-sided invasive breast cancer. She preoperatively was known to have one foci of disease in the breast, which we knew was intermediate grade and ER positive, and she elected to undergo a mastectomy and sentinel lymph node biopsy. On the final pathology, she actually had multifocal disease. She had the known 1-centimeter tumor as well as a 0.9-centimeter tumor. Both of them were moderately differentiated. There was no lymphovascular invasion. The margins were all clear. Obviously, we'd performed a mastectomy, and both were strongly ER and PR positive and HER2 negative. So she was at pathologic stage T1B multifocal disease, and her 3 sentinel lymph nodes were negative. So she was evaluated by one of my colleagues in medical oncology regarding her decisions for adjuvant therapy. An Oncotype DX test was ordered, and it returned with a recurrence score of 19.
So at that point, what was the discussion that was had with the patient? I guess primarily with the oncologist, but in terms of chemotherapy, she has a low recurrence score, maybe not as low as, for example, was reported in the big study, but still considered low. So how did that sort of translate into the decision?
Well, so the recurrent score of 19 is really right there at the borderline between low and intermediate. And so I imagine that if she would have gotten several opinions from oncologists, she probably would have received different recommendations. There are some who are comfortable with the low score cutoff of 18. There are others who prefer to use the cutoff of 11, as was used in the Taylor X trial. But the original development and the validation of the score obviously was used with the cutoff of 18 for a low score. Here at my current institution, the oncologist that she met with was comfortable treating her with adjuvant hormonal therapy, did not feel like there was a large benefit to be gained from using adjuvant chemotherapy.
Just to clarify, she had 2 primary tumors.
She did have multifocal disease, yes.
Mm-hmm. And was the oncotype done on both areas?
So the oncotype was just done on the largest of the two, which in this case, one again was 1 centimeter and one was 0.9. They were morphologically similar. They were both intermediate grade and both, again, strongly ER/PR positive and HER2 negative. So one would predict that they would have concordant oncotype scores, but that's certainly a good point when you are looking at women who have multifocal disease. If you are concerned that the biology of the 2 tumors may be different.
I see you had a paper in the Annals of Surgical Oncology not that long ago, earlier this year, not a journal I usually read, but I found it when I saw your resume, but I was really interested when I saw it, Oncotype DX and bilateral synchronous primary invasive breast cancer. What did you see there?
So we found that in the majority of the time, if a woman presents with concordance between ER/PR and HER2, that there will also be concordance with her oncotype grouping as far as low, intermediate, or high risk. But there certainly were a number of cases, I believe maybe on the order of 10% to 15%, where performing the oncotype on the contralateral tumor did in fact change treatment recommendations for the patient. So again, I think you have to take everything into consideration, the morphology of the tumor, the ER/PR HER2 status, the size obviously comes into play when we're making some decisions. But typically the pathologist will send the tumor that they would expect to have the worse biology, if we can use the word worse, you know, they'll typically pick the one that they expect to have the higher score. And if they are very similar and it's unclear which one to pick, sometimes there can be consideration for sending both.
Interesting. What was this lady's sort of attitude about chemotherapy, and was she comfortable not receiving it?
She was, yes, very comfortable not receiving it. She is actually a healthcare worker herself, and she really strongly desired avoiding chemotherapy if, in fact, there wasn't going to be a significant benefit. So she was very comfortable with the recommendation for hormone therapy.
So you've now migrated from Memorial up to Dana-Farber, 2 places where we talk a lot with the medical oncologist in terms of breast cancer, and particularly at Dana-Farber, a very pro using genomic assays, Hal Burstein, Eric Weiner, et cetera. Right now, I'm curious how genomic testing kind of fits in with the oncologists at Dana-Farber, as opposed to where you just came from, which is Memorial. And, you know, one of the questions that comes up a lot, there's a lot of debate on, is the issue of the patient with node positivity, you know, 1 to 3 positive nodes.
Yes, it's a very timely topic. So when I first moved to Dana-Farber about a year ago at Memorial, we were not sending Oncotype on women with node-positive disease. I'm honestly not clear whether they are sending it routinely now. I'm sure that they're using it in certain scenarios. But here at Dana-Farber, the oncologists are quite comfortable sending Oncotype in women with 1 to 3 positive nodes. And we have set some predefined criteria here so that, again, the surgeons can go ahead and order the test without waiting for the patient to see the medical oncologist to eliminate that delay time and being able to make those treatment decisions. So we do order it again in women who have node positive disease with 1 to 3 positive nodes if we think that there is an opportunity to assist in the decision making.
What about in node negative patients? Is that pretty much a routine? Again, issues have come up, for example, at the extremes of age, very young patients, very older patients. In general, are you sending off a 21-gene recurrence score if there are node negative?
In general, yes, but we do have some size criteria, and we also account for tumor grade. So we do not send it in grade 1 tumors, and there are some grade 2s where, based on size, we may not send it. So we have some criteria. If it's a T1B, grade 3, we'll send it. If it's a T1B, grade 2, we may not routinely send it, but we have these discussions back and forth with our oncologist to determine who they'd like to have the result for.
We saw some interesting papers that you've done looking at lobular carcinoma in situ. Can you comment a little bit on that entity and what we've learned about it recently? Particularly, I was curious about some of the genomic findings that have been seen there.
Sure, yes. So lobular carcinoma in situ is a challenging entity for us in clinical practice. It's frequently an incidental finding. As you know, when women have a breast biopsy for something else, the pathologist will report the presence of LCIS. We know that the presence of LCIS, when it's associated with a breast cancer, we know that it doesn't change outcomes. It's not a contraindication to breast conservation therapy, and we don't need to achieve negative margins when LCIS is around a tumor. But when LCIS is found in isolation in a woman who does not have breast cancer, we have often counseled those patients that LCIS is a risk factor for the future development of breast cancer, and that risk tends to be quoted at about 1% per year. It's an interesting lesion in that the risk is conferred equally to both breasts, so not necessarily the breast that the LCIS was found in. And we know from historical studies that that's because frequently LCIS is actually multifocal or bilateral. So when a woman is found to have it in one breast, she typically will have it in the other breast as well, even if we have not had a biopsy to prove that. So we do counsel women that LCIS is a risk factor. They are at increased risk for developing breast cancer. Women with LCIS tend to get ER-positive breast cancer, so chemo prevention is a very good option. And in our data from Memorial, we demonstrated quite nicely the reduced risk of breast cancer in women who take chemo prevention. But it's become a little more controversial in recent years, as you suggested, because of the genomic studies. And now that we're able to do deeper sequencing and targeted sequencing on these small lobular carcinoma in situ lesions, we're demonstrating that they have very similar mutational patterns to the adjacent cancers that these women develop. So many of these women will develop invasive lobular cancers, although it's still pretty even split, 50-50. Women with LCIS also get invasive ductal cancers. But when we look at the characteristics of the LCIS and the adjacent cancers, we see, again, very similar mutational patterns. We see very similar copy number gains and losses when we look at DNA and similar expression patterns of proteins. And so this leads us back to the concept that LCIS is likely, in fact, a non-obligate precursor to some breast cancer. So in some women, that LCIS probably is responsible for the cancer that's developed, whereas in other women, we don't see these changes. And so in other women, the LCIS probably will never become cancer. So similar to the problems that we have with DCIS, we know that not all women with DCIS will get invasive breast cancer, but yet we have historically treated all women with DCIS to prevent the development of breast cancer. So these new genomic studies challenge us in a way. If we believe that some LCIS will progress, the challenge is now again to identify which ones will perhaps offer those women more aggressive treatment and reassure the ones that won't progress that their lesion does not have that potential.
We were talking about genomic assays, and I was curious what we know about special tumor types in terms of invasive cancer, beginning with lobular carcinoma.
So recently, the TCGA on lobular cancers was published, and so it's the largest series of comprehensive profiling on invasive lobular cancers. And what we learned was that, not surprisingly, mutations in the CDH1 gene, or E-cadherin, that was the most common alteration in invasive lobular cancers. And our pathologists have told us for a long time that loss of E-cadherin expression defines the lobular phenotype, and now with this large comprehensive profiling study, it's been confirmed that, in fact, mutations in CDH1 are the most common alteration. Interestingly, mutations in PIK3CA are the second most common, and that goes along with findings of other ER-positive breast cancer subtypes. And when we look at the transcriptome, lobular cancers are largely of the luminal A phenotypes, again, going along with what we know about them tending to have lower rates of proliferation, lower grade malignancies. There wasn't really anything that was unknown, per se, that came out of the comprehensive profiling study, but it does provide us with some additional insight into deciphering the differences between these low-grade ER-positive breast cancers. There probably are some differences between the lobular luminal A's and the ductal luminal A's.
What do we know about genomic findings? For example, the 21-gene recurrence score in patients with lobular carcinoma. I remember seeing one series where there were actually, people think of it, I think, as a pretty indolent, sort of non-chemo-responsive disease. But I was surprised. I remember seeing one series where there were a lot of intermediate score oncotypes there.
So I think just as there's a spectrum of everything, there's a spectrum within lobulars, and every once in a while we will see a lobular that's HER2 positive, we will see a lobular that is low ER positivity or a higher grade tumor. And so certainly we have to consider all those factors. Overwhelmingly, lobulars are low to intermediate grade ER positive, relatively indolent tumors, but certainly there can be some outliers.
So let's go on to your next case, your 36-year-old lady.
So this is a 36-year-old who was diagnosed with a clinical T2N0 triple negative cancer. She presented to us with a mammogram and ultrasound workup demonstrating this lesion. And I said clinically she was node negative and her ultrasound of her axilla was node negative. As she was young, presenting with triple negative disease, she did undergo genetic counseling and genetic testing. She did not carry an inherited predisposition to triple negative disease. And therefore, she was eligible for one of our preoperative trials for triple negative breast cancer. And so this particular trial that she elected to participate in was a trial of neoadjuvant cisplatin versus paclitaxel for triple negative cancer. And this trial is looking at the HRD assay, the homologous recombination deficiency assay, to see if pathologic complete response rates to cisplatin or paclitaxel correlate with homologous recombination deficiency in women with triple negative breast cancer.
And you referred to the fact that you did genetic testing. Of course, that was BRCA testing. And, you know, the BRCA germline associated breast cancers are known to have HRD, although I'm not sure I completely understand what it is. It gets tied into the use of platinum and PARP inhibitors, I guess, at least experimentally. And I imagine that's the basis for this study.
Yes, the known hereditary BRCA mutation tumors do tend to have deficiency of DNA repair mechanisms, and HRD is one of those repair mechanisms. So if somebody has a germline BRCA1 mutation, then their tumor will be HRD deficient and potentially more susceptible to agents that cause DNA damage. But we also know that there are some sporadic triple negative breast cancers that also have HRD deficiency. And so the idea is, can we use an assay to identify those women because they may also be good candidates for these agents?
Another issue is the issue of neoadjuvant therapy in general in a patient like this. Now, this patient's primary tumor was 4 centimeters?
Yes.
And what about breast conservation? How large was her breast? What were her thoughts about it? What were your thoughts about breast conservation?
Yeah, so I was strongly in favor of her having preoperative therapy, whether it was on or off protocol, because she did have a roughly 4-centimeter tumor at the 6 o'clock pole of her breast. She was a borderline candidate for conservation for sure, given her breast size and the tumor size. And given the triple negative phenotype, it was highly likely that we would get some shrinkage, at least, if not a complete pathologic response with preoperative therapy. So she was motivated to attempt breast conservation, and so therefore I was motivated for her to have preoperative therapy to see if we could optimize our cosmetic result.
Now, I noticed in your write-up you had that her axillary exam was negative, but you still went ahead and did a ultrasound of the axilla. Is that typically how you approach imaging of the axilla in a patient with a negative clinical axilla who's going to get neoadjuvant therapy?
So I typically do not, but she came to us with her imaging having been done already outside. So in a clinically negative axilla, and particularly in someone, she's young and quite thin, so I was confident as one can be in their clinical axillary exam. I do not do routine axillary imaging. It's quite controversial, as you know, if you take a survey or read the literature, there's a wide range of opinions regarding the rationale for that. And a lot of the enthusiasm towards doing axillary imaging or dedicated imaging of any type to identify patients with potentially positive nodes comes from, I think, two directions. One is there are, of course, two very important ongoing trials right now of patients who we know are node positive, who undergo preoperative therapy and then become clinically node negative, looking at whether we can alternate axillary node dissection for axillary radiation in those that remain node positive at surgery. And then the second trial looking at those that are in fact negative at surgery, looking at whether we can potentially tailor our radiation therapy. Radiation oncologists around the country, they have become quite vocal about wanting that dedicated axillary imaging before pre-op therapy, even in women who are clinically node negative, because they would like that information in their treatment planning post therapy. So you'll hear lots of different opinions about it, but I do not routinely do it.
So what happened with this lady? What's her current situation?
So she is undergoing her preoperative therapy. She's having a very nice response.
As you know, because you participated in a survey that we did of 61 investigators, half surgeons, half oncologists, we actually presented that as a poster at San Antonio. Now, this patient, you know, had a particular reason to get neoadjuvant therapy in that she wanted breast conservation and really would have done better with tumor shrinkage. But for the more typical patient where that's not an issue, one of the things that we saw in this survey that was very interesting was that both in patients who are triple negative as well as HER2 positive, very proactive about using neoadjuvant therapy, both the oncologists and the surgeons, as opposed to, for example, ER positive, HER2 negative disease. And what we actually saw was that a majority of the investigators, again, for HER2 positive or triple negative, would prefer seeing the patient get neoadjuvant therapy, even if the axilla was completely negative, the tumor was 2 centimeters or greater. Again, do you buy into this sort of ER HER2 based algorithm and this proactivity about neoadjuvant therapy?
I actually do, and I think that it's really exciting for patients because I think from a surgical point of view, what's driving our enthusiasm is the opportunity to avoid the axillary node dissection and the subsequent morbidity for our patients. So we know even if women are clinically node negative, depending on the tumor size, you know, there's still a real chance that we'll find microscopic disease if we went to surgery primarily. And so just having, you know, the increased rates of pathologic complete response that we're seeing, we know the rates of PCR are actually high in the nodes than they are in the breast. We've seen reports of them being as high as 90% with HER2 positive therapy. Certainly with triple negative disease, they're at least 50%. And so I really do think that it's an important conversation to have because if we can sterilize that nodal basin, we really spare our patients one of the things that they're most concerned about, which is that risk of lymphedema.
And, you know, it's interesting, too. People originally, I think, when they thought about neoadjuvant therapy, were hoping, you know, Bernie Fisher, et cetera, that it would affect long-term distant recurrence, which it doesn't seem to do. And it's kind of ironic now that it's sort of come full circle that there's a lot of proactivity, but it's really about reducing local therapy. As you say, the axilla. I've also heard people say, even if they're doing a mastectomy, they'd rather have the tumor shrunk down first, in terms of ease of surgery, margins, et cetera. Again, do you sort of buy into that?
Sure. There are times when, even if you're doing a mastectomy, if the tumor is particularly close to the pectoralis muscle or particularly close to the skin, you know, there's nothing to lose by shrinking that tumor down, even if you're still going to do a mastectomy. Also, you know, today we see a lot of women who are choosing to have mastectomies for personal reasons. So we might tell them they're perfectly good candidates for breast conservation therapy, but yet they still choose to have a mastectomy. And so we are not seeing rates of breast conservation increase to the extent that we're seeing, again, rates of path CR increase in the breast, right? So we have all these new neoadjuvant trials, particularly in the HER2 positive setting, where we're seeing PATH CR rates of 50, 60%. But yet, if you look at rates of conservation in those studies, they're no better than they were in the older pre-op ACT studies. So we certainly haven't capitalized on neoadjuvant therapy for breast preservation as much as maybe we thought we would before. And again, that's a complicated decision-making process between the patient and her physician, whether she wants to choose to save her breast. But the new sort of just appreciation of how we can do less in the axilla, I think it's a very important factor because every woman wants to avoid that risk.
There was one other thing we saw in this survey that I thought was very fascinating, which is the question of management of the patient with ER-positive, HER2-negative tumors where neoadjuvant therapy is a consideration. And we know that sort of globally, those patients don't seem to respond as well to chemotherapy. What we saw in the survey was that either the oncologists or surgeons favored just sending the patient to surgery and skipping neoadjuvant therapy, or interestingly, about a third of the investigators are actually using genomic assays to sort of help make the decision, mainly the 21 gene recurrence score, the thinking being that even though we don't have that much data, we know the same tumor post-op, we're going to do that test and it's going to help us decide about chemo. What about at Dana-Farber and in your own practice, do you ever consider genomic assays in a patient with an ER-positive, HER2-negative tumor where you're thinking about neoadjuvant therapy, maybe even considering neoadjuvant hormonal therapy?
Yes, and that's a very good point. And we struggle with these cases, certainly, particularly in the patients that would benefit from some downstaging. It's important, I think, to remember when we say ER-positive tumors don't respond as well, really what we're saying is that they don't have as high of pathologic complete response rates. And to optimize a woman's opportunity for breast conservation, we don't need a PATH CR. We just need some shrinkage in the majority of cases. And so I think we, again, have to be careful. You know, what is our goal? What are we going for here? We do use neoadjuvant endocrine therapy in some patients. We were doing it on trial in the alternate study. We also have a pre-op trial here for invasive lobular cancers, ER positive with neoadjuvant endocrine therapy. And so we have, again, do it on study, and I have had some patients where we've used pre-op endocrine therapy off study too in selected patients who are motivated. We know that you have to stay on the endocrine therapy for an extended period of time, typically the 4 to 6 month window to really see that optimal response. But for some patients, that is an attractive option. Using the genomic test is also very interesting. I know there's at least one publication in the literature supporting the use of Oncotype 21 gene recurrence score to identify those women that would benefit from preoperative chemotherapy in the setting of ER-positive disease. I have not had a particular case where we've done that, but I certainly understand the rationale if you're struggling with that decision up front and have something to gain from giving pre-op therapy.
Let's move on and talk a little bit about DCIS, and maybe to get into that, you can present your 50-year-old lady.
So this is a 50-year-old perimenopausal patient who, on a screening mammogram, was noted to have a small group of calcifications in the upper outer aspect of her right breast. She returned for additional imaging, confirming this, what was described as a 4-millimeter area of calcifications, and a stereotactic biopsy demonstrated DCIS, intermediate nuclear grade, some area concerning for microinvasion, but there was a note that there was a lot of artifact associated with those changes, and so they weren't really clear that it was actually microinvasion. It was ER positive. Post-biopsy imaging confirmed that the clip was in the appropriate position, and she then presented to see us at Dana-Farber. We reviewed her outside imaging, and we thought that she could benefit from some additional magnification views. And on those views, we actually identified a second area of calcifications. They were about 2 centimeters away from the original biopsy-proven area, but they were quite superficial near the nipple-areolar complex, and they were not amenable to a stereotactic biopsy. So I took her to the operating room and performed an excisional biopsy for that second area and then performed the lumpectomy for the DCIS. Both of these were done through the same incision, a radial incision in the 9 o'clock position of the breast, and her cosmesis was very good afterwards. Of course, I removed a small amount of tissue at the undiagnosed area and a more appropriate amount of tissue at the area that we knew had DCIS. The pathology from the known tumor bed, there was actually no residual DCIS there. Everything was benign, some atypical duct hyperplasia. And the pathology from the more anterior area that was undiagnosed did also demonstrate ductocarcinoma in situ of intermediate grade. And two of the margins were less than the new standard of 2 millimeter margins for DCIS. So the medial margin was 0.1 to 0.2 millimeters, and the anterior margin was actually positive. There was ink on the DCIS. My practice is to also perform a post-excision mammogram after I excise DCIS that presents as calcifications. And particularly in this case, because I had the positive margin, I wanted to ensure that if we were to take her back for repeat excision, that we were able to localize any residual calcifications at that site. Post-excision mammogram did not identify any residual calcifications related to that anterior group, but it did identify now a third small area that was now better seen more laterally. In retrospect, of course, the radiologist went back and said, oh, yes, these were probably here kind of thing, which always makes surgeons crazy. But so on that post-excision mammo, now we were faced with the decision about this third very small cluster, which was, again, in an area where we had negative margins, and then we had to deal with the area where we had a positive margin more anteriorly. So because she was a young woman and now we're clearly dealing with this multifocal DCIS, which we know happens, but I wanted to be sure before I counseled her regarding her options, I wanted to be sure that my radiation oncologist would still be comfortable treating her with whole breast radiation therapy with or without a boost, given these sort of three foci of disease. So we presented her at our multidisciplinary tumor board, reviewed all the imaging, and they did feel that if we could achieve negative margins and that the patient was still satisfied with the cosmetic outcome, that they would feel comfortable treating her conservatively. So she then returned to the operating room, and thank goodness that time it was good news. So clear margins anteriorly. And the third little spot was, in fact, another small area of DCIS, but that also had clear margins at the time of excision.
So the plan for her?
So she's receiving whole breast radiation therapy, and she will then be counseled regarding the potential benefit of anti-estrogen therapy, also given that her DCIS was ER positive.
Any comments about, we're talking about the genomic assays for invasive cancer, including the 21 gene recurrence score, but there's also a genomic assay for DCIS. It doesn't seem like it's been used anywhere near as much. Can you talk about what we know about that, whether you thought about that in this lady, or do you use it at all?
Yes, so it's an important question. So the DCIS score, again, you mentioned a genomic assay for DCIS, very similar to the 21 gene recurrence score. The genes aren't exactly the same, but certainly the concept is the same, where the score separates women into low, intermediate, or high risk, not for distant recurrence now, which the invasive test does, but low, intermediate, or high risk for in-breast recurrence. And that in-breast recurrence, we know, can be either DCIS again, or it can be invasive cancer. I think the limitation of the DCIS score is, although it does provide us that prognostic information, so it may be a useful tool for counseling women as to what their risk of recurrence is, the DCIS score does not tell us anything predictive about response to therapy. So, for example, even if a woman has a low DCIS score with the genomic test, it doesn't tell us that she won't benefit from radiation. And again, that's really the value, or one of the biggest values of the score that we use in invasive cancer, is that a low score in invasive cancer tells us the woman will not benefit from chemotherapy, that we can just use hormonal therapy and feel confident. If we had that extra piece of information from the DCIS score, if we could say, okay, you fall into the low-risk category and we know that radiation's not going to help you, then I think it would have greater traction in clinical practice than what we're seeing now. But what it does tell us now is certainly it can be useful as a decision-making tool if a patient is not quite sure whether she wants radiation therapy. If the score were to come back quite high, demonstrating that she has a high risk of in-breast recurrence, maybe that would help her in making her decision. But there's, again, not as much discrimination between an intermediate and a high score in the DCIS test as there is in the invasive test. So it really gives us two categories, a quote-unquote low risk, which is not as low as some might want. So the low risk score at 10 years, the risk of cancer recurring in the breast is about 12%. So for some women, 12% doesn't sound too low. The high risk score, the risk of cancer recurring in the breast, is on the order of 25 to 30%. That's certainly high for many women. But again, the piece of information that's missing from that test is who will benefit from radiation. And so until we get that piece, we are still in this quandary of treating everybody or trying to use clinical factors to sort of weed out who maybe doesn't need radiation.
You mentioned the sort of new standard or new paper that came out looking at margins in DCIS. Previously, there was another similar sort of consensus paper, invasive disease, which used the NSABP no inkling margins. And as you said, this new paper, again, your former colleague, Dr. Morrow, 2 millimeters. Can you talk a little bit about the basis for what they came out with, and whether you agree with it?
Sure. So Dr. Morrow and colleagues, they did a very intensive systematic review of the literature of all the papers that were published that looked at in-breast recurrence following conservative treatment for DCIS, looking at what margin widths were reported. The meta-analysis was again performed, looking to see if there is an optimal margin width that reduces the risk of in-breast recurrence. And then a consensus conference was held where experts from the different groups, the SSO, ASTRO, and ASCO, came together to discuss the results of the meta-analysis and to put together the consensus statement on what is an adequate margin width. And the final result, as we said, was that in pure DCIS, it appears that a margin width of 2 millimeters is associated with low rates of local recurrence, and there's no benefit to a wider margin than 2 millimeters for reducing local recurrence in women who are going to receive radiation therapy. Now, there is a series from Memorial Sloan Kettering. Dr. Kim Van Zee is the senior author, a large group of women treated conservatively for DCIS, the majority of whom did receive radiation therapy. But when you look at the actual quite large number of women in that series who did not receive radiation therapy, in those women, it does appear like margin width may actually correlate with risk of recurrence. So in women not receiving radiation, it may be that the wider margin is better. But in women receiving radiation therapy, the 2 millimeters is what was determined to be the appropriate width based on the meta-analysis.
I'm kind of curious, what was your approach to margin width or margins in general with DCIS before this paper? And did it change?
So in general, with margins at Memorial, we always sort of had a range of sort of that we liked 1 to 2 millimeter margin on DCIS. We certainly did not use the same tumor on ink as we use in invasive cancer, but we didn't have a real strict cutoff. And certainly there are patient factors and tumor factors that come into play. Which margin is it that might be close? What's the age of the patient? Again, is she going to receive radiation and whatnot? So we didn't have a hard and fast rule, but most of us did go for, a 1 to 2 millimeter margin in DCIS.
What are some of the most common questions you get from surgeons about management of patients with DCIS?
I think as surgeons, we are struggling with this concept of over-treatment, right? So we know that many of these women will never go on to get invasive breast cancer, and we'd love to be able to predict who will and who won't so that we could tailor our therapies and spare some of the morbidity for these women. A challenge that we have is we know that when DCIS is diagnosed on core needle biopsy, we know that there's about a 15% rate that they will actually be found to have invasive disease when they go to surgery, even just for simple excision. And so some of the studies coming out now of randomizing women to observation alone for DCIS versus standard therapy give some people pause, because we know that some of those women in the observation-only arm will in fact have invasive cancer that is undiagnosed. But having said that, we also know that there are lots of invasive cancers that if they went undiagnosed would probably not cause patients a problem either. And so we just come back to this real need and desire to even further our understanding of the biology of some of these more indolent lesions so that we can continue to tailor our therapies and continue to move towards that less is more philosophy. But it's a challenging time for us because, patients want to know what their options are. There's a lot of attention around DCIS in the media, in the lay press, the concept of overtreatment, of overdiagnosis. And so it's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity for us to really try to figure out who can be spared our standard therapies.
I'm curious about the most common questions you receive from surgeons in community practice.
I think management of the lymph nodes is a very important topic for surgeons right now, really trying to define what we're comfortable with as far as sentinel node after neoadjuvant therapy in patients who were known to be node positive. Multiple groups are looking at their own experiences and adopting different techniques, such as perhaps clipping the positive node before treatment to ensure that it's removed. In the Netherlands, our colleagues are using a MARI technique where they put in a small radioactive seed into the clip node, and then they ensure that they remove that node post-treatment with the identification of the gamma probe. So I think we're going to see a lot of attention around these efforts to really understand what's safe to do in the axilla after neoadjuvant therapy. And I think it's great for our patients because, again, avoiding that extra morbidity from the node dissection is certainly a key factor for them. Here in Boston, we've recently gone to iodine 125 seeds for localization of our non-palpable lesions. Although we were doing this in New York for many, many years, we've now adopted that here in our Boston institutions, and it's really changing the way that our clinical practice goes. And so I would encourage any surgeons out there who have not yet tried I-125 seed localization for lesions to do so, because it's wonderful for patients and it's also great for your workflow.